I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. By now, you've seen the horrifying pictures of the Amtrak passenger train derailment in Washington State on Monday morning that killed three people and injured 100 more. The train was reportedly going 80 miles an hour around a curve in a 30-mile-per-hour zone and went off the track. Some train cars fell onto the interstate below. Here's the conductor calling in to report the accident to dispatchers.
Hey, guys, what happened?
We're coming around the corner to take the bridge over I-5 there, right north of Nisqually, and we went on the ground.
Okay, are you, is everybody okay?
I'm still figuring that out. We got cars everywhere and down onto the highway.
Okay, copy that.
Here's Chris Carnes, who was a passenger on this train, describing what happened, a clip from CNN News.
We had just passed the city of DuPont. And it seemed like we were going around a curve, and all of a sudden we felt sort of this rocking and creaking noise, and then all of a sudden it felt like we were heading down a hill, and the next thing that we know, like, we're being slammed into the front of our seats, and the windows are breaking, and then we stop, and there's water that's gushing out of the top of the train, and all the lights go out, and people are screaming.
Frightening. This was the maiden voyage for a new line connecting Seattle and Portland, and the accident was similar to one that happened in Philadelphia more than 2 years ago when a speeding train went off the tracks, killing 8 and injuring 200. We asked Alan Zaremski to join us. He's a professor and director of the Railroad Engineering and Safety Program in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Delaware. Alan, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Also with us is Robert Puentes. He's president and CEO of the ENO Center for Transportation. That's a policy consulting group whose goal is to improve transportation. And he joins us from the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C. And Robert, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
It's great to be with you again. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Let's talk about, I realize here it is Thursday, this happened on Monday, but there are still some unanswered questions. But I guess the critical one is, why was this train going 80 miles an hour in a 30-mile-per-hour zone? To you, Alan, what is the possible explanation for that?
Right now, the most likely explanation, you know, all the information is not fully in, but right now all the information seems to be pointing to some sort of operator issue here, operator distraction or operator inability to slow the train down prior to getting to that curve where it derailed.
I read that there was reportedly an employee being trained who was in the cab with the engineer. I don't know if that's true or not, but I read about it in several places. Alan, would that possibly describe some kind of engineer distraction?
I've heard the same reports, and in general, you know, it might be possible, but in general, having two people in the cab is a very common occurrence. For example, virtually every freight train that operates in the United States has a two-man crew in the cab by law. So any freight, you know, with Burlington Northern or any other freight railroad were operating on that line. In fact, that was a BNSF line before they sold it to Sound Transit. They would be required to have a two-man crew. In addition to that, having somebody else in the crew to familiarize themselves with the route. That's what I heard. In fact, that this was somebody being trained to be familiar with the route, so he would have to be on the cab to see the route for himself before he actually took the controls. That's not an unusual occurrence. So while it's definitely possible that the two of them were distracting, you know, engaged in some situation that was distracting. Having two people in the cab of a locomotive in and of itself is not an uncommon situation. In fact, a very common situation.
I hear you. Robert Puentes, what questions do you have?
I think we have these catastrophes on the rail system like we had in Philadelphia a few years ago. it brings up these questions about something called positive train control, which is a system that's put in place, a technological advance, where the trains and the train tracks are talking to one another, preventing some of these hazardous conditions from occurring and taking control of the train, slowing it down in this case, and trying to ameliorate some of these problems. The National Transportation Safety Board recently found that this PTC, this positive train control, could prevent about 25 fatal accidents in the United States over the last decade. So it appears that the PTC was installed on this stretch of track or was going to be installed. But there's some delay here in why the system was running and when the PTC was not performing.
Well, and Robert, going back to what you just said, this was something that was called for, what, about a decade ago, that this was after a pretty tragic accident in California, this need for positive train control. But here we are, what, 10 years later, and it's installed in some parts of our track system, but not clearly all of them.
No, not all of them. It's getting there. There's a mandate that's been extended, so the rail systems have to have it all done by the end of 2018. They have extensions for that, and there's ability for places to have more time. But I think we're getting there. It's just taking longer for lots of different reasons.
Well, it's very expensive, for one, as I understand it.
Indeed.
I mean, billions, right, to install?
Yes, price tag that's being used is about $10 billion.
And who pays for that? I mean, does that come out of Amtrak's budget, Alan, or –
No, that would be the price tag for the entire U.S. railway system. So, but that's a good point. This was a non-funded government mandate, which means basically the government says that it must be in place by December 31st, 2018. However, they did not provide money to anybody to do that. They would have to take it all out of their own monies. So the private railroads, for example, they're paying for it out of their capital program accounts, taking money from other capital programs and using it for that. And people like Amtrak and commuter railroads probably have to go to their funding sources. They do have to go to their funding sources to get the additional funding for PTC.
And Robert, if it were in place, it would have – so here's a train going in towards a curve requiring a 30-mile-per-hour speed. It would have slowed the train down to that speed? That's how it works?
Yeah. I mean, it's designed to avoid these hazardous situations and take control if the operator fails to do so. So as was mentioned, if the operator was of error here, the technology would have taken over and prevented the accident. In theory.
Now, this was a maiden voyage, so there was obvious and new or refurbished track. And I'm just speculating here, so Alan, let me go back to you. Would there be questions about the track itself?
Before we had all that information, there were a lot of that was a possibility because it was a newly upgraded track. The overspeed would have really nothing to do with the track. The speed is determined as a function of the several factors, but the curvature and the elevation of the track, which is established, and that 30 mile per hour was probably set based on the curvature and elevation of the that curve. I have heard speculation in the press, and there's nothing but speculation at this point in time, that there might have been some object on the track as well. But right now, from the information that's out there, the derailment is certainly not inconsistent with an overspeed type of derailment, similar to what happened in Philadelphia a couple of years ago.
Yes,
and also what happened in Spain a couple of years ago, where in both cases a train was going at significantly higher speeds around the curve and derailed.
Robert, should we be nervous or afraid about riding passenger trains in the United States?
No, I don't think so. I mean, clearly the health and safety of infrastructure is a paramount concern to policymakers and public and private leaders all over the place. I mean, clearly the system has to be safe. And when we have these tragedies that have occurred from time to time, there's a lot of discussion about the infrastructure in the United States. We have a lot of discussion, and then little seems to really happen. So I think that this crisis-driven approach that we seem to be taking towards infrastructure doesn't seem to be working. We need to figure out from a positive and affirmative standpoint, because clearly the system has to be safe, but we need to think about, well, what is the system designed to do? What are we trying to get out of the infrastructure that we have? And then how do we make the right kind of investments to keep the systems up and running and performing the way it should? So clearly safety is paramount. I don't think that there's any reason for folks to be alarmed across the country. But, you know, we really need to think about different ways to invest in infrastructure rather than just going from crisis to crisis.
Well, you mentioned the fact that and Philadelphia is such a prime example because it was a train that was going much too fast around a curve, a very well-known curve in Philadelphia for the railroad tracks. And again, 8 people killed, 200 injured, some of them really seriously injured. And yet, as you say, Robert Puentes, little happened. I mean, it does raise a question about, so what would it take?
Actually,
and this is Alan. Go ahead. That's all right.
Sorry, it's hard to interrupt, but actually, when you say little happened after the Philadelphia derailment, that's not quite true, because Amtrak actually accelerated and put in place its positive train control on the Northeast Corridor, and that went in at the end of 2016, there was a push. That particular accident was a Northeast Corridor accident, and in the Northeast Corridor, Amtrak owns both the track and the trains, so it is easier for them to be able to implement positive train control in a situation where they control both sides of the system. Elsewhere in the United States, to include Seattle, to include the Tacoma area, Amtrak is responsible for the locomotive portion of positive train control, but they're not responsible for the track portion of positive train control, which is a responsibility of the infrastructure owner.
Oh, I appreciate that correction. And we should underscore the Northeast Corridor, Alan, the busiest corridor for Amtrak, correct?
Correct, by far.
By far. Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation, talking with Alan Zaremski. He's a professor and director of the Railroad Engineering and Safety Program in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Delaware. Robert Puentes is with us as well, president and CEO of the Eno Center for Transportation. That's a policy consulting group. Their goal, their mission is to improve transportation. We're talking about the Amtrak train derailment in Washington State earlier this week. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Alan Zaremski and Robert Puentes about the Amtrak train derailment in Washington State on Monday that killed 3 people, injured about 100, highlighting some concerns about railroad safety and the state of our infrastructure. A little bit later on in the show, we'll be talking more about things like bridges and roads. President Trump has promised a big infrastructure initiative when the new year starts in 2018. In the meantime, you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get John from Mannheim to join us. John, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to get the opinion of the gentleman. We've had trains for 100 years now. The infrastructure is in place. Why hasn't that technology proliferated to the point where it's safer, faster, and less expensive for customers as compared to they're spending all this money to proliferate autonomous driving vehicles technology? And undoubtedly, to perfect that technology, there's going to be catastrophic crashes, I foresee.
So you're saying, why don't we have autonomous trains? Is that what you're saying?
Well, no, to perfect train technology where it's viable, faster, safer, cheaper. You know, I could go from Pennsylvania to California for $10 instead of what it costs.
Well, that's an interesting question. Let me see if Alan Zaremski can respond to that. And let me just add, because I think people that have taken trains in Europe and people that I know that have taken trains in Japan always say their systems seem to be so much more efficient, more on time, even better than what we have in this country. Alan, can you talk to what John was raising?
Yeah, I can talk to a couple of those points. I suspect very much the answer to John's question is that we still remain an automobile culture here in the United States, and people still love their automobiles and don't want to leave them. It's true we don't have the same extensive passenger rail network here as we have in Europe. We actually happen to have one of the world's best freight networks. That's according to the World Bank. So it's not that we don't have good rail service. We have focused our attention on freight rather than passenger for a variety of reasons, not the least of which freight pays for itself and passengers needs to be subsidized. So we have made as a government, we've made some decisions to focus our transportation resources in non-rail-related areas, particularly when we're talking about interurban rail, in other words, rail operations between major cities, because clearly we have lots of commuter rail and transit systems which are thriving and well.
And this rail was between two cities in Washington state. Robert Puentes, President Trump said that long-distance trains are kind of a vestige of the olden days when trains were the only option, especially for rural parts of this country. Now he says we've got planes, we've got buses, we certainly have the interstate highway. Is there some truth to what he said?
Well, when we think about rail in this country, It's really a tale of two different systems. We do have these long distance routes that travel across the continent, right? I mean, it's really, really long distances that clearly are served more efficiently by aviation. People still take them. That's great. But really where rail is competitive, as Alan was saying, is particularly in the Northeast Corridor, these shorter routes between major metropolitan areas, probably about 500 miles, seems to be about the right distance where rail is competitive, where it's like, too short to fly, right, too long to drive. In the Northeast Corridor, rail is extremely competitive. So more people to take the train between Washington and New York than fly, for example. The system is super, super efficient. It works really well. I think the Seattle-Portland corridor where this accident occurred is another one of those corridors. So we have to look at the system not just as this giant transcontinental system, because I think it's right. It's really hard for anything to compete, and even the European models aren't, you know, California to New York by rail. It's these shorter distances between major metros that already have some kind of economic connection between them. It's very effective that way.
Alan, let me ask you about something that the National Transportation Safety Board said, criticizing Amtrak, saying it fostered a, quote, deficient safety culture. There was a reference to an accident that actually occurred here locally in Chester, Pennsylvania. This was about April 2016. Two railroad workers were killed. 39 passengers were injured. The NTSB said there was a, quote, culture of fear on the one hand and normalization of deviance from rules on the other. What do you make of that? And that's a pretty serious charge.
Yes, it was. And as you pointed out, it stemmed from an accident where there was a lack of communication between track workers, people working on the track, and the dispatcher who was responsible for operating the train. And it was something that should never have happened. It certainly exposed Amtrak to this issue of safety culture. The situation in this recent derailment is a little bit different. But having said that, we have to make sure we'll have to see what exactly happened with the train engineer, the train driver, and what happened there. But certainly there was no issues of somebody being on the track or any lack of communications between the track people and the operating people. But the whole issue of a safety culture is a concept that we see We've seen in several instances recently, for example, there were a similar issue was raised with Washington Metro not that long ago, where they also had a series of they've had a series of accidents, and the same broad issue of safety culture was raised there. And I think what you find is that the entities, Amtrak and Washington Metro and others, will end up taking this very seriously because it is an issue that you can see some organizations that really do have a strong safety culture and others that need to work on it.
Robert, anything you want to add to what Alan just said there?
Nope, I think he nailed it. That's exactly right. It's starting to change. These high-profile disasters do start to change that culture, but it has to be paramount, as he said.
Alan, final question to you. There are data recorders. I assume there are probably cameras on board this train that derailed. Will that, do you think, be important as this investigation continues?
Well, the data recorders are absolutely critical. In fact, the information about the speed, the NTSB has already accessed the data recorders. So all the information that you hear out there about the accurate speeds going into the curve, and not only that, there was a very important piece of information that they presented that there was no indication of an engineer initiated braking action prior to the derailment, and that the only braking was initiated by the one that's associated with the derailment, basically whenever there's a disruption in the brake line or there's some unaccounted for event, there'll be an automatic braking. But those type of information comes right out of the event recorder that's on board the locomotives. The cameras, I understand there were cameras on board. I also heard a report that that the forward-facing camera on the at least one of the cameras on the lead locomotive was damaged in the accident, and the NTSB was trying to see if there was a way of salvaging the images from that camera.
Well, Alan Zaremski, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times once again to talk about a tragic train derailment. But we really appreciate your expertise.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. That's Alan Zaremski, professor and director of the Railroad Engineering and Safety Program in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Delaware. I do want to shift gears and talk more broadly about infrastructure. The president tweeted shortly after the accident on Monday that it showed why his infrastructure plan must be approved by Congress quickly. Problem is, according to the Washington Post, his transportation budget cuts funding for long-distance Amtrak service and limits expansion for public transit. Trump said he will unveil his $12 trillion infrastructure plan next year. The American Society of Civil Engineers has said the nation needs to spend $4.6 trillion on the country's roads and dams, airports, water and electrical systems, and gives our country a D-plus for our infrastructure. Staying with us for the rest of the hour, Robert Puentes, president and CEO of the Eno Center for Transportation, a policy consulting group, and they want to improve transportation in the United States. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Robert Puentes, as we were beginning the show today, our reporter here at WHYY reporting that SEPTA's regional rail system has basically dealing with downed power lines. I mean, this is sort of just the reality, I guess, of trying to get people around an area. But nonetheless, all these, death by a thousand cuts, all these make it really hard for public transit.
Yeah, indeed. And it shows how all this is interrelated. I mean, the problem is happening on the regional rail system, as you mentioned, but it's because of an electricity issue, right, and transmission issues. So we think about infrastructure as if it's this one big thing, but it really isn't infrastructure. It's all these different sectors energy, transportation, mm-hmm. water, telecommunications, and all of these different sectors are designed and governed and financed and delivered very, very differently. Some have a very heavy public sector role, some have a very heavy private sector role, some have these new kinds of partnerships, some have a big regulatory role. And so it sounds like something only a think tanky person here in Washington would care about, but it actually matters because when we think about, well, who is responsible for these problems, these challenges that we're facing, it's a big mix. And when you talk about trillions and trillions of dollars worth of needs and investments, people think, well, this is gigantic. Only the federal government can take care of something like this. But the reality is, what I mentioned earlier, is that when I say nothing seems to happen, I mean nothing seems to happen on the national level, where we're seeing our cities, states, metropolitan areas, public and the private sector starting to step up and starting to do some of that work. But most of the action is coming from outside of Washington, not inside.
Well, and as you were talking, I was also thinking on Sunday when the Atlanta airport went down, essentially because of electrical problems. There was a fire, sure. I believe, that basically took down the airport for a lot of that day.
Yeah, and this is the issue. That what happened in Atlanta, where power, as you said, was knocked out to the airport, it's the world's busiest airport. And in Seattle, where the derailment we just talked about, all that fits into this national narrative about crumbling infrastructure. But it's really not a neat fit. It's not the neat fit I think the president is trying to make it. Because in neither case, as we've talked about, is it old infrastructure that failed the same way a structurally deficient bridge would fail or a water main would fail, or the deteriorating subways here in Washington or in New York. What we're really seeing in some of these cases is a lack of technological upgrades and modernization that may have prevented both those problems in Atlanta and Seattle. And it's what we're seeing, I think, around the world. It's not the envy that we don't have the infrastructure in place. We do have the infrastructure. But what we see internationally in other modern economies is modern infrastructure. We have an infrastructure that is more related to the previous economy and the previous generation than it is in the future. And so when your caller talked earlier about, well, look what's happening with autonomous vehicles. You know, this is taking the country by storm. Everybody's preparing for a future of autonomous vehicles. That's largely private sector driven, right? These are private firms, private companies that are seeing a market opportunity, and they're working with public agencies and cities and trying to smooth the pathway here. But these aren't massive public investments like we'd seen them in previous history here in the United States.
So how would you then modernize our infrastructure, knowing, of course, how inclusive that is?
Yeah, again, it gets back to this larger issue of it being lots of different actors that are involved here. So the question would have to be more, well, how do you modernize X? Like, how do you modernize the electricity grid? Or how do you modernize the intercity rail system? Or how do you modernize air traffic control? All of these things have very, very different answers. They're all related. They're all under this big umbrella of infrastructure. But the answers are all very, very different and very precise depending on what kind of infrastructure we're talking about.
How would you, though, I'm asking you to do perhaps the impossible, but how would you prioritize that?
Yeah, it's hard to answer. I think that when you think about government expenses, I think one of the crises that we're having is around our water infrastructure. And water infrastructure was highlighted nationally because of the problems that we had in Flint, Michigan a few years ago.
Yep.
That became a big national story, an international story. There's a lot of those around the country, particularly in the Northeast and the Midwest and places where the infrastructure had been built out for a long time. And it's part of this larger issue where we have done a good job in this country building new stuff, and we continue to, in fast-growing parts of the country, in the West and the Intermountain West. But we've got to get to a better system where we're maintaining the system that we have right now. We can't leave it because it's not designed to last in perpetuity. It has to be repaired and paid attention to over its lifespan. And that's where we need to get to in this country. It's all about what Alan said earlier about this culture of safety. It's really about a culture of maintenance and repair as well.
And maintenance is not particularly glamorous. My husband and I took the Gothels Bridge to New York. I mean, it's a beautiful new bridge. What can I say?
Yeah, and yay to get into the cliche, but it's the it's easy to cut a ribbon in front of a new roadway, a new train station. It's really hard to cut a ribbon in front of a new sensor, right, or a new data mining equipment, all of which can be really important and can actually squeeze much more efficiency out of the system than a lot of new infrastructure can. But some of this is politically driven, particularly on the, you know, when you're talking about public investments.
Let me read a couple of comments. One from an email from Jim in Mount Airy. I use Amtrak regularly to travel from my home in Philly to my organization's headquarters in Manhattan. I hear people talking about how great it would be if we could make our trains faster. I'm baffled by that idea. How fast do we need to go from one pace to another? The regular Amtrak train takes 75 to 80 minutes from Philly to New York. His basic message is just slow down and enjoy the ride. A tweet from Jim: with the train accident in Washington, wasn't this a new line? How come the safety features with the slowing down on curves was not installed on the new line? And I think, Robert, that is a question that hangs over that accident earlier this week.
Yeah, indeed. Clearly, there's pressure to get these services up and running. Especially, it was, you know, this is money that was that came from the last administration's the stimulus package.
Right.
I believe it's where it came from, this high-speed rail money that they had. And so there's pressure to make sure you get it done because there are timelines and deadlines and all that, and I can understand that. And then this the deadline for positive train control is related, but it's different. And so I think that the plan was to get it done, but clearly this is not the only system in the country that's not running, that's running without positive train control. But I think those are the questions we're going to see answered in the next few weeks.
Almost having a break here, but what you've got are multiple systems who may not be talking to each other, right?
Yeah, and I think it's really interesting when you think about just in Seattle, there's the Washington State Department of Transportation. There's Sound Transit, the regional transit authority there. There's Amtrak, the national rail network, and public and private and lots of different actors there. It's easy to try to point fingers. But in something like this, there's lots of different folks to point the finger at.
That's Robert Puentes, our guest, as we finish out this hour on Radio Times, talking about infrastructure. We're talking, began the conversation talking about that derailment in Washington State on Monday. But when we talk about infrastructure, of course, it includes bridges and roads and electrical grids and plumbing and all of those important things. He's president and CEO of the Eno Center for Transportation, a public policy consulting group. And we want to hear from you. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. It's the Infrastructure Hour on Radio Times. Today, I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Robert Puentes. Let me get Paul from outside of Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Paul. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, yes. Amid all this talk of positive train control and high-tech solutions on this line in Washington, where obviously there was a straightaway that must have been high speed, how come there was no simple large sign, flashing sign saying slow down in the next mile or something like there is on any normal highway if you have to have a major slowdown?
Well, it's a very basic and interesting question, Robert. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I really don't know. But I can tell you, I'm sure that the operators were trained. I know that I'm sure they had tested the track, so I'm sure they were somehow familiar with it. I just don't want to speculate for what happened in this case. We just don't know yet, but I'm sure that those basic safety features were in place.
And I do want to move on, if we can, from what happened in Washington and, again, speak more broadly about infrastructure. And this may be a more political question, Robert Puentes, than I mean it to be. But obviously the tax bill is going to go into effect in 2018. And you can argue about what's in and what's out, who wins and who loses. But I wonder whether infrastructure has lost in the debate over the tax bill.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned it. I think that is there's some thought to that, because there's a lot of effort and a lot of attention has gone into this tax bill for obvious reasons. We don't have to get into that. But the president has talked about the plan to spend about $200 billion in direct federal funding for this infrastructure initiative, which they think is going to which the speculation is that it's going to leverage an additional $800 billion in funds from state and local governments and from the private sector. The challenge here now is that given some of the budget rules and given the way that Washington operates now, that you need ways to pay for this $200 billion. And you need to have – it can't just be just debt, right? So they've got to target some kind of pay-fors for this investment. And a lot of this is going to get used up in this tax the tax bill. So, you know, we expect something to be released in January. Maybe the State of the Union is the right time for something like this from the president, but how we're going to pay for it is has enormous questions right now. I don't think anybody really has a good sense of what's going to look like right now.
Well, I'm thinking about the stimulus package, which invested in infrastructure projects. It seems that infrastructure does translate into jobs. I'm not sure how many jobs. Can you help us understand that?
Yeah, it's, there are you know, for these, you know, back when we had the stimulus package, right? We recall it was, we were losing hundreds of thousands of jobs. So this was really about what they were calling, quote unquote, shovel ready projects. Let's put people to work immediately, you know, because we're hemorrhaging, and we really needed to help out individuals. And so that was kind of the focus there, was to just put people to work right now. And there's lots and lots of projects to get done. But infrastructure and jobs go hand in hand. They're, you know, when you look very broadly and take a broad definition for infrastructure, 11% of the U.S. workforce is directly employed in infrastructure occupations. This is not indirect. This is not cutting the hair of the guy who's filling the pothole or anything like that. This is directly involved in infrastructure. And so it's an enormous amount. In the Philadelphia region, it's about 10%. And so The infrastructure and jobs really do go hand in hand. And when we think about the public investments that we're making in infrastructure, we there's a disconnect between the job conversation on one hand and then the infrastructure conversation on the other hand. All of this is fundamentally related. And I think some of the frustration that folks have is that we tend to treat infrastructure by itself. And we have infrastructure for infrastructure's sake, and we're building things. But it's all derivative of these larger goals and objectives. So if job creation, good jobs, middle-class jobs, if this is where you want to focus, infrastructure is a huge part of that. If economic growth and competitiveness and international exports and things like that are your economic objective, infrastructure is a huge part of that. So we've got to nest it as a derivative of these larger goals and objectives rather than infrastructure for its own sake.
Plus, you can't outsource those jobs, right? I mean, these have to be largely Americans who are building roads and bridges or repairing them.
Exactly right. And we've heard in a couple of cases, because we have such an infusion of technology into the infrastructure system, that we're looking at the skills gap that's occurring across a lot of different areas of infrastructure. And even though we may have the money, the resources, the commitment to building things, we've got to make sure we have the labor force that's ready to do it. And there's a case to be made there, because these jobs, particularly at the lower end of the scale, come with really good benefits. Often cases, they come with workforce training. They're usually unionized and labor-protected jobs. And so they're really, really good, particularly for folks at the lower end of the scale. But there again, there's a disconnect here between this national conversation and then the jobs that infrastructure can provide.
Are you worried that partisanship will sort of drive apart Republicans and Democrats when they actually might agree on most of what you just said there?
Yeah, you know, partisanship. I'm here in Washington. Let's
yeah. You're living it, right?
But the frustrating thing is, because infrastructure is not just bipartisan, it's really been nonpartisan for years and years and years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the cliche is no Republican roads, no Democratic bridges. And it's really true. But everything in Washington is politicized these days, and infrastructure is getting caught up in that. There's no doubt about it.
Let me see what Jose from South Jersey has to say. Jose, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi, good morning.
Morning.
I'd like to see if you could comment or what your thoughts are on the implementation of electronic logs nationally in the trucking industry. And I just finished hearing what you said, and I agree with it to a large degree, except that I see a large number of people leaving the industry, which is already in crisis. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on this.
And these are people leaving the trucking industry, correct, Jose?
Yes, they're leaving the trucking industry. There's long hours,
right.
Low pay, and now the implementation of these logs is probably going to drive more experienced people out of the industry for this.
I appreciate the call. We actually did a show about that. What are your thoughts, Robert?
I think he's right, and particularly as it relates to logistics and trucking broadly. When we think about, as I said, those stats on infrastructure, 11% of the workforce. And I'm looking here at a chart from in Philadelphia alone. This is in 2012 from the Brookings Institution, that several of these categories at the top of the list in terms of jobs and infrastructure are in trucking, light truck, service delivery operators, industrial truck operators, tractor operators. I mean, so this is a huge source of jobs in infrastructure in many, many different regions. But as the caller said, we are facing a shortage. Which is starting to take place, you know, from coast to coast, and all this is also getting caught up in this larger conversation around technology and automation and what all this is going to mean. I think some of that is overblown, particularly in the short term. You know, we're going to need folks in these vehicles and operating and driving them, even in freight, where I think we're going to see some of these advanced technologies start to take place earlier than on the passenger side. But the caller is exactly right. We've got to do a better job of training folks, getting them into the workforce, and probably starting even earlier, starting in high school and letting kids understand that these are good-paying jobs with good benefits. Trucking, it may not be always the best. There's these are long hours,
sure,
take you away from home and all that
sure
kind of stuff. But we can't just pretend that this is a problem that's not going to go away without some direct attention to it.
What do you see as the future for autonomous trucks and even cars?
Well, for trucks, I think that we may see it on some of these longer distance routes. You could see, for example, a driver being in total control, leaving Chicago, for example, navigating through that dense metropolitan area and then hopping on I-80, in rural parts of the Midwest. And then you can see where the automated functions start to kick in on the way out to, to California. Then when you get back into the urban dense area, maybe the driver starts taking over again. But I think we're going to see in some of those closed systems also some of these autonomous functions taking over. But we're still a ways away.
People living in and around Philadelphia know that I-95 has been under construction. I've kind of lost count how many years. But, obviously hasn't been forever, but it's been a fairly long time. And widening the road for the excess traffic. Is there a danger that when you widen a road or a highway, you just create more traffic because now people want to drive it?
Sure, we could do a whole show on this concept of induced demand and whether or not all this makes sense. I do think that there is this the Sisyphusian kind of strategy of you're pushing the rock up the hill and it's going to roll back down again, because you're right, the traffic does seem to fill back up again. And so places are starting to do something very, very different. Here in the Washington region, for example, where we have chronic traffic, years and years, generations of traffic, on the Washington Beltway, for example, they could have taken a strategy where we're just going to widen the thing again, it'll fill up and we're just going through the same cycle. But particularly in Northern Virginia, they focused on putting in different kind of toll lanes, high mm-hmm. occupancy toll lanes that are dynamically priced. In other words, depending on the level of traffic on the Beltway, those tolls will be higher to encourage people to, to make sure that they're still flowing very smoothly. This is a public-private venture. It seems to be working quite well. The money that's being generated is helping out this private partner in this case, but it's also providing benefit for people who are doing HOV, who are carpooling, people who are taking public transit, for example. And so there's a lot of new ideas that are starting to percolate around the country, and I think we're starting to move away from just building infrastructure and just chasing just trying to chase traffic congestion relief.
There was a story this morning on Morning Edition about something called transportation resilience alternatives. Maybe you go, I don't know. I had never heard of that before, but it was having that if you're stuck in traffic, the importance of having an exit out of that traffic jam.
Sure.
Redundancy. Yeah.
Sure.
I mean, how does that work?
The idea being that you can if you have one metropolitan area that's focused on one mode of transportation. I think they use Jacksonville as the example, where you're pretty much driving in a place like Jacksonville. And if there is a problem on a bridge or on a pinch point or a heavy traffic corridor, you're pretty much out of luck. And they mentioned in this story that the researchers were surprised a place like New York, as congested as it is actually extraordinarily resilient, because mm-hmm. there are so many different options, so many different ways for people to get around: public transit, walking, biking, whatever, anything else. And people are basically closer together, and so the land use actually supports those different kinds of modes. And so some of this actually, I think, is intuitive to some people. The more options you have, the less distance you have to travel, the easier it's going to be. But again, we keep chasing these old strategies of just dealing with the roadway network and building so that traffic is flowing smoothly. We just can't afford to do it anymore.
And what's a smart road these days?
I think a lot of this is really about this larger issue of the application of technology to all kinds of areas of the infrastructure. A smart road would have digitized infrastructure would have a lot of sensors embedded in it so that we can continually receive information about how the roadway is performing and make adjustments. You know, something is in tolling. You would know that there are traffic incidents. You can dispatch tow trucks to clear up incidents really, really quickly. But it's all around this larger idea about making sure that these systems are as technologically advanced as they possibly can be to avoid the need to spend billions and billions of dollars for traditional infrastructure. We've got to make sure they're running as efficiently as it can before we make those bigger investments.
You mentioned the fact that there is a fair amount of activity on the local level. So I'm assuming for states, they can use the gas tax or the fuel tax, I guess their fees, their ballot initiatives. Is that where the investment and the money is coming from?
For a large part is, and this is a key part of the administration's strategy, they really want to encourage other sources of funding other than federal funding, and they want to incentivize that. And so I think that they're proposing different ways to incentivize places to raise their own taxes, either with the legislature or going to the ballot box. And we've seen hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of these measures, particularly in the last election, the big election we had during the presidential, where there was $200 billion plus in infrastructure that was approved by voters all across the country, but particularly in the fast-growing parts where we're talking about new infrastructure for the most cases. So we do see this happening. It's not going to be very even because there are places in the country, think about maybe a St. Louis or a Detroit, that doesn't have the same kind of fiscal capacity, and people may not be able to vote for sales tax increases and things like that to pay for their infrastructure. But the point here is that cities and metropolitan areas and states, to some extent, aren't waiting around for Washington to get their act together. They're out doing things, and that should be encouraged where they can handle it.
An email from Kirsten. America needs Robert Puentes in the current administration. I just share that with you. Does that interest you?
It's a really, really tough time to be here in Washington. It's you hear stories, people say that it's as tough as they've ever seen, and I think that's certainly true. Mm-hmm. But again, it's in sharp contrast to what we see happening outside. There's an enormous climate for people to do things and for cities and metropolitan areas to learn from one another. And so when people would come into Washington now and stop in to see us, they don't necessarily, or you know, they're not necessarily going to see their congressional delegation looking for you know, for earmarks and you know, for that kind of spending. They want to know, tell me about what they're doing in Chicago. I heard about this project in Kansas City, and I heard that this thing failed in this region. Why did they fail? How can I learn from this? So, you know, this is America. People are still aren't just sitting around waiting, you know, for things to happen to them. They're actually starting to do and to innovate. Lots of interesting times, lots of interesting pilots. It's actually a really great time to be working in infrastructure and transportation, as challenging and dysfunctional as it may seem on the national level.
Well, that's good to know. I saved a question that we could spend an hour on for the very end. We've got about 45 seconds. But how much do you think climate change is affecting infrastructure? And how much do you think we have to think about that when building, designing for the future?
I'm actually encouraged by the attention that this has gotten over the last few years. I think we still have a long way to go, but you know, it's hard to not pay attention to it when we have the natural disasters that happened in Florida and in Houston, you know, just this past year. And then we see what happens to the infrastructure and the way that we build, the way we think about the built environment, and that these 100-year storms, which seem to be happening every year now, that message is starting to sink in. And you can almost get beyond the question of who's responsible. That's almost, in this case, it's not really the point. The point is, well, we've got to make sure that our places are able to withstand these disasters, which seem to be happening in such regularity. And infrastructure is, you know, just this part of this larger conversation about the built environment, the things that we're building, and how it's affected by these natural disasters.
Robert Puentes, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
I really appreciate it. Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And he joined us from the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C. He is president and CEO of the Eno Center for Transportation. Charlie Kyer, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for joining us.